Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Renewable Heating and Cooling Webinar Series, Financial Models, Emerging Trends in Commercial Solar. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star then zero, and an operator will come back online to assist you. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. James Critchfield with the Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Critchfield, please go ahead.
Thank you, and welcome to the third installment of EPA's Renewable Heating and Cooling Webinar Series. As was mentioned, my name is James Critchfield. I work here at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, who is hosting today's webinar. Today's webinar focus is on financial models that are used in the deployment of commercial solar thermal projects. As a few points of logistics that I'd like to go over, attendees will be placed on global mute for the duration of today's webinar. If you have any questions, there is a Q&A window located on the right side of your screen. Please feel free to type in your questions at the text box at the bottom of that window. We will be answering questions from attendees at the end of today's webinar presentations, and there will be a PDF of today's webinar presentation available, as well as an encore audio replay. Access information for both the presentation and the audio replay will be sent by email to all registrants at the conclusion of today's webinar. In terms of webinar structure, I am pleased to welcome several experts who are with us today to discuss various financial models that are currently being used in the market today for solar thermal water heating projects. Our first speaker is Jill Clyburn, who will also be moderating today's webinar. Jill has a long career in both energy efficiency and renewable energy. She has supported local, state, and regional agencies, businesses, and utilities in the development and design of clean energy programs for more than 20 years. She's also currently the president of Clyburn & Associates, a consulting firm that specializes in clean energy feasibility and economic assessments, as well as implementation, planning, and media strategy and execution. So with that, Jill, I'd turn over the webinar to you, and you're on.
Well, thank you, Jim. My presentation today is going to be very short because I know each of the individuals who is presenting today, at least have spoken with them and researched some of their experiences and case studies over the years. I know that you'll all want to hear a lot more from them, perhaps, than you want to hear from me. But as Jim suggested, my business and my specialty is to research best practices. And so that is how I know these folks who demonstrate these best practices. I think that anyone who is in the field with a commercial facility or a local government facility or maybe some collection of facilities like a military base or a college might first want to explore, well, what are my options? And the major stumbling block for solar water heating is oftentimes in the financing. You've all passed the first test, which is to say that you've all come to this webinar and decided that solar water heating is worth considering, at least to some degree. And perhaps by the end of this call, you'll have more information and sophisticated thoughts about this. But you know, when you're talking about water in commercial facilities, there's always a little hesitation. And I think that that's one of the things that has held this industry back. There is a lot more sophistication now in the technology and a lot better track record than perhaps some of the stories you might have heard from the past, although sometimes I think those might have been just stories too. The research that I did most recently was for the Solar Electric Power Association, where we were looking at solar water heating as a technology that has existed for a long time but has never really taken off, captured the market, until perhaps some of these financing models. And we know that that has been the case in the PV industry, that it was financing that made the difference. So, you know, perhaps that is one of the major things that could really open the market, and if you are in that market, make it more appealing for your business. So we're going to talk about those new business models and the innovation specifically in the financing end. Also, from my point of view, one of the pieces that I'm working in a lot has to do with the utility relationship And I do think that, there may be some advantages to working with solar thermal, solar water heating, when it comes to that relationship that you have with your particularly electric utility. These are just some examples of the solar water heating or solar thermal technologies that we see today. And these are systems that are not represented, the company's not represented here today, just to let you know that there are a great breadth of companies that are working in this field and more and more in the financing end of it as well. One in particular, now the top one that you're seeing is that's actually a Southern Energy Management project at a college, I believe. The one on the bottom, the important thing about that is it's a little different technology, evacuated tubes, and some of our other speakers may be using this technology and tell you about it. It also has a long track record and is probably the technology of choice in China, so don't imagine that it's completely new. The one on the right, though, perhaps is considered a little more new, and that one is a concentrating collector at a lower temperature. We normally think of concentrating collectors as power towers and massive things. This particular system is from Sopogee, which is a Hawaii-based company, and they run in the heat range between 200 and 620 or so degrees. And so these systems are useful for particularly heat and power systems. You can imagine you've got a solar water heating system to serve all those kinds of needs related in the facility. And then if the water were hot enough, you could be generating from that and satisfy many, many of your energy needs with this type of system. Of course, it's got a price tag on it, and you've got to be the right kind of business to benefit from it. And I think that that's really one of the reasons why we're here today, is to give you some ideas about what kind of questions to ask. Because in this field, really I think the major situation we see when we see a dissatisfied customer or a system that didn't work out was that it wasn't the right fit. So that is part of getting the system right, is making sure that you're asking the right questions when you work with these folks. So this slide shows that SEPA report. The Solar Electric Power Association serves the entire industry, not just electric utilities, although that is perhaps the primary market. So you could go to that solarelectricpower.org website and see more about this study that they did. So here are the models that we're looking at. Now, some of these are very familiar, and some of them you can think of, you know, based on your experience as a homeowner or your experience as a person who does purchasing of any kinds of equipment or services for a commercial facility. Loans are very common, and they are still a relevant model if you happen to be a person who has, that kind of a need. In order to get a loan for these systems, however, sometimes you have to do an awful lot of proving because they are not that common. And the larger systems, which have a higher price tag, involve a lot of engineering. And so the third-party models emerged partly to make this a much simpler approach for you. ESCOs are energy service companies, and I think Bill Guiney is one in particular who can discuss that. And leasing is something that has turned the PV industry really completely into a moving market, especially in the smaller systems where people are leasing systems. Again, the problems that are happening occasionally on the residential systems are probably less likely to happen on a commercial system because you've already been told, you know, that this match is the important thing. And I think when you hear about any kind of leasing projects that are not working out that well, it tends to be because there's a poor match, not a really good need for the service that's being provided through the lease, or perhaps a misunderstanding on the fine print. The other models, the shared revenue model and the energy purchase model, are going to be discussed here today. And these are refinements. people who worked with leasing, people who worked with ESCOs, and they said, okay, we've seen some issues, we want to resolve those issues, and these are the business model solutions that we offer. So you'll hear plenty about that, and I just wanted to speak for a moment more about the utility piece. Now, when you're talking about water, if you have a natural gas utility, you may be working with a natural gas utility to serve those needs through a conventional method. In some parts of the country, electric water heating is something that you might want to do, but of course, I think most of these folks that are going to be on our panel today are working with the natural gas as the competing fuel source. However, when you talk about solar, you're usually thinking about the electric utility because we think about PV. And in fact, the electric utility is also interested in some things that you're doing in your facility that relate to your solar water heating system. And by that I mean energy efficiency measures and demand-side management measures or demand response, taking load management into consideration. So it might be worthwhile to have a conversation about these things. In the states listed here, New York, Maryland, North Carolina, Arizona, Nevada, and Washington, D.C., the energy created through a solar water heating system can be converted into a kilowatt-hour equivalent that has a REC value, a renewable energy credit value, and that's an added value to your system. The electric utilities are the ones that usually are going after those renewable energy credits. So that's an interesting conversation that you or your provider may have. Then there's also the whole idea about, well, gee, solar PV is coming down in cost. Why not consider that? Well, one of the things that I've been working on a lot lately with commercial clients and also with utilities is this very question. As PV becomes more and more popular, utilities are actually struggling to keep up. Some of them are more than happy to interconnect solar PV systems. Others, although they may be happy, are completely backed up and you're not going to get online in a big hurry. Others are concerned about the penetration of PV on their systems and what that might do to their infrastructure, so you get into a lot of interesting conversations with the utility. With solar water heating, you avoid all that. And yet, if you're going after green energy building points, things like that, solar water heating is a qualification. So in some sense, solar thermal, solar water heating is a way around some of the barriers that we've experienced in the past with utilities. And perhaps it's going to be a way for utilities to catch up a bit. It's a perfectly reasonable way to do solar and still give the utility some time perhaps to get its infrastructure and its interconnection agreements and all of that ready so that perhaps some point in the future you may go to PV. So those are my thoughts on that subject, and now I think you'll like to hear some of the business model leaders, and the first of these is Dale. I don't know, Jim, are you going to introduce our individual speakers, or is this something that I'm doing? I'm just going to say I'm doing it. Dale is a founding partner at FLS Energy and has overseen its growth from 3 employees in 2006 to 75 employees today. He's led the company in creating processes that have enabled it to grow, and it really has been an outstanding company in this business, and also Dale has been a player not only in leading business but also in extending his services, knowledge, and expertise to the solar industry to help solve some of the problems that the industry has had and upgrade the quality of service really nationwide. I think without reading the rest of his slide, I will introduce Dale and let you tell you all about his experiences working with these solar financing projects. Dale?
Great. Thank you, Jill. And thanks, everybody, for attending. And I thought I would start today by giving just a quick introduction to FLS Energy and then go right into the one of the models that we use for financing projects on a commercial scale. And so SLS Energy was started about 6 years ago, and we saw solar thermal as a market segment where we could compete very aggressively with photovoltaic. At the time, solar thermal was about 5 times more cost effective than photovoltaic systems were, and now that is down to about 2 or 3 times more cost effective than photovoltaic systems. And as we've seen, a dramatic decrease in the cost of the photovoltaic systems, solar thermal has been incremental in its cost savings. But I think one of the things that we've seen almost from competition coming from solar PV is that the solar thermal industry is looking at innovative ways to reduce the cost and increase the production from solar thermal. We certainly have seen that in commercial scale projects where we're able to deploy many thousands of square feet of collectors to a single facility. And as Jill mentioned in her introduction, we have had great success working with the utilities, not only in creating a REC value, but in creating ways to structure these projects so that they actually become an asset to the utility. So we are in many ways we're not supplementing the base load demand that they have on the utility generation for the electricity, but we're supplementing other sources of energy, whether it be oil or propane or natural gas. And I think that leads to also one of the biggest challenges that we've seen in the commercial solar thermal world is the major competitor fuel source for us is natural gas. And the fact that natural gas prices are at historic lows has been a real challenge to the industry. And I think using these financing models has what has enabled us to be able to offer solar thermal at competitive prices. And that's what we literally are doing. We're building systems and offering them to the market through these power purchase agreements, similar to the way they're doing a lot of the solar PV now. So in a conventional equipment purchase for any client, normally they take the incentives, so they'll take the tax credits and use those. They will get any of the environmental benefits or the renewable energy certificates, and they would contract with a firm like SLS Energy to do an installation, and we would recognize that revenue on that installation, and everybody would be satisfied. And that certainly is great, as the bullets indicate there, where there's places the businesses have the capital or they have their own tax appetite, or especially in projects where it's tied into new construction and they can use the low-cost long-term debt to help finance that project. But that segment is very it's very limited as to the amount of clients that can actually take advantage of the incentives. In our model, what we do is similar to what other folks do, is we actually do a power purchase agreement where the client contracts with us to build a system, and we only sell the energy to the client. And therefore, we provide all the capital to build the system, and we own the system, and we are taking the incentives, the tax credits, and we are taking the benefit of the renewable energy credits, and generally we're selling those to a utility. And then obviously businesses that don't have the upfront capital, or nonprofit organizations, or even groups that do not want to deal with the maintenance and the long-term performance guarantees from solar thermal. So there's a very large segment that likes this model. And what I thought I'd do today is get into kind of the nitty-gritty of one of the models that we use to enable us to actually provide this benefit to the customers and sell just the energy. And there are many different financing models, as Jill mentioned. There's leasing options and there's ESCOs. What we generally do is we take a model where we sell only the energy to the client, and then we might lease space from that same client for their roof or for their land. And we utilize many different tax credit structures, but the basic one here that I'm showing is called the master tenant structure or an inverted lease structure, and that is based on the low-income housing tax credit structure that's been around for many, many years. So what we have in that situation is we have two kind of key players, and on the left side you have the array owner, who is the
company that we form. It's an LLC that we form that actually builds and owns and maintains the array. And then on the right side is what we call the master tenant, or the lessee in this situation. And that is an LLC that we form that is created to push equity into the array owner to allow them to build the array. And then the investment tax credits and the net operating losses are able to be selected to push through to the master tenant. So you have one array owner on the left-hand side, and then you have a master tenant that is able to take the tax benefits and the losses and then allocate those out to its members. So what we do through the FLS model that we're using is we have an installer that designs and procures and installs the system for the array owner, and that's basically just a regular installation contract. And then we at the array level, we go out and get the construction financing. So we'll have lines of credit or we'll have permanent debt on the system. We bring those loans into the array owner LLC. And then those funds, in addition to the tax credit equity that's coming in from the master tenant, flow to pay for the installation of the system. And in the case of FLS Energy, we're handling the EPC work ourselves for the array owner, and then we also maintain the system and guarantee production. And then in addition to that, we have the tax credit investor, who is generally somebody that is a bank or an insurance company or some large player that has significant federal and or state tax credit liability that wants to monetize those that liability. So they turn it into an investment. So basically, the tax credit investor is making an equity investment into the master tenant, and that master tenant then is using that same cash to fund the array owner. And then again, as I mentioned before, the tax credits flow back through the master tenant and then up to the tax credit investor, and as do the losses. So any depreciation benefits or net operating losses from the system also flow back up through to that tax credit investor. So by virtue of this model, we're able to offer a bank or insurance company or other tax credit investor a very positive return on their investment, and sometimes in the high teens or low 20s for an IRR. So it's a very attractive investment for those entities when at other things they're looking at are in the high single digits or maybe low teens for investments. So this works very well for us, and it allows us to bring money into onto our balance sheet through consolidation that comes in as equity and not debt. So for FLS Energy, we're building a balance sheet by bringing in the tax credit equity investors into the master tenant and then the array owner. And then we obviously have to have an energy off-taker who is buying the power. And that there is generally a power purchase agreement through the master tenant where whatever site we put this system on, we have contracted, and they're buying strictly the energy. So that contract then is just a pay-as-you-go kind of utility purchase agreement, where whatever we produce for the month, we bill the customer and they pay us. So it's an ongoing revenue stream that comes in to the master tenant, and then those funds do flow back to the array owner as a lease payment. So that master tenant or the lessee is actually paying a lease payment monthly or quarterly to the array owner, and then those funds are what are available on a long-term basis for FLS Energy as the array owner. And generally, I didn't put it on this screen, but there are many other agreements that go into this structure. One of the other ones that's kind of a key component at the master tenant level is in certain areas, as Jill mentioned, in New York or Maryland, and certainly here in North Carolina where we do the majority of our projects, we have a contract with the utility where they will buy the renewable energy certificates. And that has worked very well as a way to supplement the tax credits that come in and has been key to us being able to offer the energy to the client at a reduced rate. And generally, we're selling that energy at about a 20% reduction as to what they would otherwise pay, even in the case of natural gas. And then just to go down and show a couple a couple projects and talk quickly about them. The first here is the Camp Lejeune military base. It's the Marine base here in Jacksonville, North Carolina. And we contracted with the company that has the housing contract. So they're leasing the space from the military, and they own the housing units. So we contracted with that entity to provide the hot water for 2,200 homes on this base. And it has been a huge success as a project. Our initial scope was 900 homes. Before we had finished installing 500 of those homes, the base had seen such drastic reduction of utility costs in the homes where we had applied these panels that they increased it to 2,200 homes. We're about to do another third phase on this base and have taken this to several other bases and are getting ready to install early in 2013 in a number of different states, solar hot water on the military housing. And so as you're looking at that picture, each one of those panels is a 40-square-foot panel, a 4x10 collector that was made right here in the United States from AET down in Jacksonville, Florida. And that provides about 50 gallons of hot water per day for each of the units. So you're looking at two panels on each of those roofs, and that is really two units. And the next picture is the Prestige Farms, which is 2,100 collectors, or about 80,000 square feet of collector space going into a single point of usage. And that project has 225,000 gallons of storage, and we're delivering about 80 million BTUs a day to that facility. We're offsetting propane, and again, that has been a huge success for us in energy generation. And it also had many technical kind of things that we had to learn along the way. In fact, you're looking at 80,000 square feet of collector storage, and if the demand is not there in the building, it very quickly gets to high temperatures in that site. So we've had to do some creative design and engineering manipulation of the system to make sure that we're delivering the energy that we had promised to the host there. And so that project is the largest flat plate collector system in the United States, and has been on since about January of this year. We turned a couple of the arrays on December of last year, but the full array came totally on in January of this year. So it's been a huge success for us, and we plan on doing many projects along that line. And with that is the end of my presentation. I have the question slide here, but I guess we're going to hold the questions to the end. So with that, I'll turn it back to Jill.
Thanks, Dale. I was actually typing an answer to a questioner who was questioning the relationship that the relationship is with a master tenant and not with the individual tenants. And I think I hit on some aspects of that question, but if you might want to add a few thoughts on the structure of that relationship. You had a slide about it. I don't know if you need to return to the slide, but
Jill, I think I can quickly touch on that. So the model that I showed there is a tax credit, a model to monetize the tax credits. So it's not a direct lease with a homeowner or a business where a lot on the photovoltaic side, they're doing a direct kind of equipment lease. What we're doing is we're bringing in the tax credit investor who technically owns the assets, and we are applying those assets to the array owner. And the way that we're able to do that is a kind of an internal lease. So if we have a bank that invests in the master tenant, the master tenant sends those funds over to the array owner and then leases the equipment back. So it's all a transaction that is handled by FLS Energy and the tax credit investor. It is not a lease transaction at all between FLS Energy or the investor and the host or the client that we're selling the energy to. And so as far as the host is concerned, all they're doing is paying for energy, and FLS Energy then behind the scenes has deals and promises to the investor that they'll make returns, and all that financing is done independent of the off-taker of the energy.
Excellent. Thank you. I think that's pretty clear. And we will have more questions at the end if we have time, which I hope we will. Our next speaker is Zach Axelrod, who is the CEO and founder of Skyline Innovations. He founded this company with the name Innovations, and I do think that is a very appropriate term. He'll explain exactly how the model works, but it is one of the newer models to appear on the scene, and I think he'll verify that it's been very successful. He also serves on the SEIA board, the Solar Industries Association board, and his background is that he comes from GridPoint and having worked with the smart grid economic model. So, Zach, I'll introduce you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I have to apologize here that my internet has gone in and out, so if you wouldn't mind clicking me forward here, again, I apologize for that. I appreciate getting a chance to talk through our company and the industry. I think sales hit on most factors of power purchase agreements. Certainly what we offer is a form of that. And so what I'll do is kind of go through a few things that we do differently. But again, a lot of what Dale's gone through and a lot of what they saw 6 years ago in the opportunity in solar thermal, we saw 3 years ago when we entered the market, which was a solution that makes a lot of sense for specific market segments. And that certainly had a role even as PV was taking off, but there were better fundamental economics for a lot of projects. And that was something we were interested in. We actually started out, just as some quick background on us before kind of walking through our financing structure and how it differs just slightly. We actually started out as a business model looking for a technology. We came up with the idea for a specific market segment, which was kind of that mid-sized commercial world, really between, if you looked at Dale sites, kind of between single-family residential and the huge industrial and municipal and government market was trying to figure out an approach that would bring energy savings to that mid-sized commercial world, apartment buildings, smaller office buildings, et cetera. And we decided to take an approach of shared savings, of measuring what we had delivered, which was kind of our backgrounds from GridPoint, be it heat, light, electricity, cold air, and charging the customer a percentage of what we had saved them with no baselining, 100% monitored solutions, with the intent of basically going to a customer and saying, what you care about is hot water or light or cold air, or you don't care about electrons or BTUs. So if we could price at a guaranteed discount to whatever it is you were paying for that utility service, in doing that, you would therefore be getting cheaper hot water, light, cold air guaranteed. We did notice the positive relative economics of solar hot water, and that's where we started and that's where we stayed with that model and with this very defined customer base, primarily of apartment buildings, looking at that customer segment of mid-sized commercial. Apartment buildings and hotels really are the major hot water users in that segment. So moving forward a couple slides, just a quick snapshot of our company. We were founded 3 years ago, and now we're on both coasts in D.C. and L.A. We were very fortunate to have our projects initially invested in by Jigar Shah, Sun Edison, and some other former industry participants. And then again, we've been fortunate that our local regulated gas utility, Washington Gas, the parent company, WGL Holdings, has helped us set up a nationwide tax equity fund. Speaking to a couple differences and the financing structure that Dale mentioned with the inverted lease, we happen to use a sale leaseback. It's a fairly simple structure. When we develop projects, we sell them to a fund set up by Washington Gas that actually owns the assets. They lease them back to us, and we operate them for the customer. identical to what they'll describe. The customer, Skyline Innovations, is the face of the transaction. All they do is pay for the energy they used at that fixed discount, and the rest of it is behind the scenes with us. That includes monetizing the renewable energy credits, which we have in D.C. and Maryland, where we're based, or any other incentive structures. We've built a number of projects, about 50, on primarily apartment buildings, and we've been fortunate to get approval from HUD, and we're low-income housing tax credit compliant. We've had a small handful of customers that have verified that, which is really important in targeting this mid-sized commercial sector, because there are a lot of great potential campus-style low-income portfolios, and oftentimes to do any type of financing, one complication is that they may need HUD approval or they may need approval from their tax credit investors, and we've gone through that long process with them. I don't think I need to really speak here on the next slide to fully how a solar thermal system works for this audience, but I will note one of the things, if you're selling energy as a service that all of us on this call probably mentioned, you do have to monitor it extensively. We measure between 12 and 18 data points on the system, flows and temperatures, every second, aggregate that up into minute averages, five-minute averages, and back all that over the Internet. So if you're going to sell energy as a service, you have to monitor energy. And in our case, because we're selling it as a percentage discount to what you would have paid, we actually need that kind of energy. We need those metrics on how much we've delivered in fairly short, discrete time blocks, because you may have a time of use rate. You may have an inverted block structure. There's a number of different utility structures, more so if you're offsetting electricity than gas. But because of that, we actually measure this down to the minute, because as we dissect your utility bill, we need to know what value of energy we were offsetting. And so in order to do that, again, we do keep timestamp records of when we have delivered each BTU of heat to your water heater. Speaking, again, similarly to what Dale and FLS do, we do offer a, in fleshing out this model, it's no upfront capital outlay. Skyline Innovations puts up all that investment with our partners at Washington Gas, primarily in D.C. and Maryland, generally at about a 25% savings rate to what you would have paid over a 10-year contract, and then the customer at the end of that term can buy us out for a significantly reduced fee to what you would have paid up front, or have us continue to maintain that asset and under, you know, extending the agreement with us. So we've tried to make this, and I'll speak to this on the next two slides, what we've tried to do is eliminate reasons that you would say no to signing on to this type of deal, to installing a solar water heater. And our logic behind our business model is, if you are guaranteed to save money, then really the only reasons you'd say no, and this certainly happens, is, and the big two reasons I think that people say no, first, there are some people who say, just don't touch my roof ever under any circumstance. Generally, you find that out pretty early on in the sales conversation, and I think it's important to bring that one up, but it's also something that nobody gets seven conversations deep with you before letting you know that they feel that passionately. And the second is, you know, there's good savings, and there are savings that on a per square foot basis are generally higher than PV. But we aren't talking, for an average apartment building, we're not talking $50,000 a year. In the average apartment building, with gas prices where they are, might spend $9,000 a year on water heating, and we could bring that down, including the portion they pay back to us, let's say to seven, and so you're saving them a couple thousand dollars guaranteed, but you've got to get over that hurdle of apathy, frankly, and it's something that with low gas prices that lots of different technologies struggle with. But we've tried to take that and say, well, it's $2,000, but it will always be a positive number. Because we track your underlying price, at no point will you ever be underwater. So, yes, it's not a huge dollar amount, although in some portfolios we've done, it certainly stacks up to quite large numbers. It may not be huge, but if you could lock in a lower utility rate guaranteed where somebody else took that risk, if it's even a dollar, that should be fairly attractive. And so by taking on not just the physical performance risk of a fixed rate PPA, but also the financial performance risk where if your utility rates go down, which has certainly happened in the last couple of years, our rates go down as well. We've tried for this specific market segment to make it very hard to say no. And so the next slide, the guaranteed savings model slide, really just goes through, you know, for the life of the contract, your existing utility bill plus what you paid at Skyline is by definition lower than what you would have paid the utility if we didn't exist. After the end of the contract, you're able to buy us out and then take all of the savings or, again, have us continue on at a potentially higher savings rate to continue to maintain that asset. Showing that two slides down on the sample lag time savings, just, you know, this really comes out of what it would look like out of a proposal from us. You can see for a mid-sized system, if you assume a nominal 2% increase in the price of natural gas, and we're not particularly optimistic about gas prices jumping back up to, you know, levels from a couple years ago anytime soon, you'll have a significant but not in the tens of thousands of dollars, obviously, savings each year for the life of the contract, and then it really bumps up after that point. And looking at how this works, it is a fairly simple process. I think all of us on this call would say that what we've tried to do is make this as easy as possible. All the permitting, all of the dealing with RECs, the dealing with the tax credits, it isn't just financing and the cost of money that's being provided. If you do all these things on your own, there's a value to your time of going out and working with your accountant on the tax credit structure, of working to sell the RECs on your own, of monitoring the system. You know, if the system doesn't work, we don't eat. So there's a lot of value beyond the financing. And I think one of the things that we've learned is that when we started out, we thought every customer would ask us for shorter contracts. And what we found is that some people often ask us for a longer contract because it's that piece other than the financing that also matters and that we found matters more, which is somebody whose work life is dedicated to ensuring that system performs, because if it doesn't, they don't get paid. And I think that's really important. So we've tried to make it really simple where it's a quick proposal process, a process to review a relatively simple energy services agreement. And for these type of savings, you can't have a 50-page contract. Ours is 11 or 12. I think that's about as short as you can get it. But you've got to try and make it easy for someone. And, of course, as soon as the system is up, we take full physical and financial performance responsibility for the next several years. So I think the next couple of slides I've already really spoken to and kind of what differentiates our model is simply an ability to take on that financial risk of your utility rates. We like our model. It's not the only way, and for many customers it may not be the best way. We think for the mid-sized commercial market where a lot of people would like to be green, would like to have a solar thermal system, and knowing that you'll never be underwater is a very meaningful step towards pushing someone over the edge. For that market segment, we think it's a good model. So with that said, a couple pictures on the last slide of some systems we have here in the D.C. area and Los Angeles. Be happy to take any questions at the end. And again, thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thank you so much. Before we go on with the next speaker, we did have a few questions come up. And In fact, one of them is from myself, Zach. I know I commented previously on a question that came up where I was thinking about this in terms of a PPA, which is a power purchase agreement, and I responded, you know, as if I was talking about a PV system where you cannot have a central system that has many different customers, because then it characterizes like an electric utility.
I'm sorry?
Oops, looks like we might have lost Jill. This is James. I think in the interim, until she gets back on, what we might do, Zach, is we'll just move on to our next speaker.
Sure.
So, and we'll come back. We'll have a Q&A session at the end. We seem to be experiencing some technical difficulties today, so I apologize to everybody. Our next speaker is Bill Guinea. He's the Director of Solar Heating and Cooling at Johnson Controls. He brings a wealth of knowledge of over 30 years of experience in the solar industry as a retailer, contractor, distributor, manufacturer, and educator. He's also chair of the NABCEP Solar Heating Entry Level Committee, and he extends his knowledge about solar from thermal technologies to also include PV. He's also a solar heating design and installation trainer for Florida and the North Carolina Solar Energy Centers. So with that, Bill, I'll turn over the controls to you, and you're off and going.
Okay, thank you, Jim. James, I'm sorry. Welcome, everybody. I am going to talk about the inclusion of renewable energy systems into performance contracting. Johnson Controls, whom I work for, is a energy service company that provides performance contracting or energy efficiency projects for primarily the MUSH market, which would be municipalities, the state and federal governments, universities, K-12, and public housing are our primary markets. And obviously, Johns Controls has a very large federal business as well, so I get involved in a lot of projects on military bases. Unlike Dale, we don't get into the residential or the housing side of those facilities. Our energy performance contracting is designed to reduce energy usage, also water reductions, because we believe that is really the next big market as far as a commodity that's running out, unlike oil that we had all thought was going to happen. We reduce operating and maintenance costs as well, and work with our customers to improve their carbon footprint as well. So in short, basically that performance contracting is a procurement tool that allows people to leverage the savings they make with building improvements to pay for those improvements. And I'll need somebody to move the next slide for me. How we reduce those energy and water uses. We use a host of products and services, including the lighting upgrades, building control systems or management systems, the water conservation, including toilets, fixtures, all the water consumption or water use fixtures, temperature controls, chillers and boilers, and, of course, integrating renewable energy. And I joined Johns Controls about 6 years ago, primarily because our customer base was looking for renewables, and we integrated into our performance contracting business. So we've also branched out now into wireless infrastructure and demand response, as well as our green building solutions, with over 1,000 lead green associates at Johns Controls. And next slide is, how are these costs impacted with performance contracting, and how do I include a renewable system generally which has a very long payback? And we do this both for biomass, wind, and solar thermal technologies, and it has been a challenge in these last few months to a year with those lower natural gas costs, but it certainly has not stopped us from being able to include them for our customers. The next slide shows a performance contracting or cost today, what the utility bill is. And under the Johnson Controls business model, we'll come in and take a clean slate, look at all the assets of a building, all the lighting systems, mechanical systems, heating systems, do an inventory of those assets, and then determine what kind of measures can be applied to each of those assets to reduce energy consumption or reduce the facility operations costs as well. And then we take all of those savings and we bundle up all those measures to be able to come up with a packaged solution for our customer. So next slide shows the reduction in the energy bill, the orange portion, and then the blue portion would be the payment for the improvements. And always, typically, we're going to see some immediate savings that are being applied to the customer because this is not a shared savings event. The customer reaps all the benefit of savings. We get paid as an EPC contractor on the front end, although we do perform the measurement and verification and guarantee that performance and those savings as well, which is a very good financing model because the bank basically has zero risk. So if the customer doesn't make the savings, Johnson Controls will write a check. We have somewhere in the neighborhood of around $7 billion worth of savings, and we write a couple million dollars worth of checks a year. So overall, the losses are quite low, and generally we'll go in and find out why we're writing that check and then try to resolve that issue and get them back all in the positive mode as well. So what I have to do with renewable energy is I have to look at the after, the next slide, where all of those savings are going to the customer, and I try to bundle up all of those performance improvements, look at the savings, and then apply what additional savings I've got, and if you look at the next slide, to buy down the solar cost. So we use both those incremental savings and those end savings to be able to help our customer buy renewable energy systems. And one of the things that I deal with on a daily basis is I have to deal with states and municipalities where there are no incentives available. All of our customers are generally non-taxable entities, which means I can't even monetize the investment tax credit on the financing for our renewable systems included in a package. So I've got to be able to find those lower hanging fruit and savings to be able to apply the more costly renewable energy systems into the project. So it's a very simple model, but it certainly affords me the opportunity to fit a solar water heating system into a project where there is no savings. So I've seen projects get a renewable or a solar water heating system applied to the project, but the savings is negligible, but we are delivering what our customer is wanting, and that is renewable energy systems. And in the last couple of years, with a lot of the ARRA funding that was available through the federal government, many municipalities and states utilize those dollars for renewable energy systems, especially in areas where they were typically unfriendly utilities to renewables. So the state was able to implement solar projects without the utilities' involvement, incentives, or the tax credits as well. Going to the next slide is an example of an efficiency contract that we did at the Dallas Convention Center. It was recommissioning the chillers and cooling towers. We use some free cooling because Dallas does cool down at night. The humidity levels can be low during certain parts of the season. Lighting upgrades, control upgrades, and added a solar water heating system as well. In the next slide, it showed it was a $16 million project, and it was saving over $2 million a year in utility costs. So fitting in a solar water heating system was pretty simple in this case because we had excess savings and a pretty quick payback period. But that isn't always the case, and we're starting to see more of that now as we're seeing these low natural gas prices affecting both our biomass and our solar business as well. The next slide shows a picture of the array, the 54 collectors on the roof of the convention center providing hot water to that facility. And one of the advantages Dallas gave me was the ability to work with other convention centers across the country in implementing renewables, and also been successful in greening up a place like Miller Park with a performance contract as well. Next slide shows swimming pool systems, and we do quite a bit of pool heating as well because of the municipalities and the colleges that we deal with. And in the northern states, we actually have quite a few high schools that have swimming pools on them as well. And I generally always use a polymer collector for our pool heating systems. I've never been able to get a glaze system to cash flow properly. So I look at the potential for savings using the polymer collectors, because many of these swimming pools are used year-round. And in some cases, we can even use those systems to reject heat when necessary inside of a swimming facility. Next slide shows the Beaumont Federal Correction Facility. In March of 2011, 178 collectors, also part of a performance contract at the prison. The next one is Fort Bliss, where we actually installed a 40-ton absorption chiller as well, utilizing a micro trough collector out of Hawaii, and solar water heating systems on the dorms there as well, or the barracks as they call them. The Army now is expanding that chiller. Has been previously sized at 40 tons, but I've actually got a 100-ton machine in place, and I think they're going to opt for expanding the solar field and utilizing the 100 tons of chiller capacity in more of a district cooling system as well through a couple of buildings. Next slide is Beaver County, Utah, which was also a PV and a solar thermal facility. 7,000 gallons of hot water a day for the jail, and a 30-kilowatt PV system. Both of these projects were bundled under a performance contract, again, with no utility incentives available and also no federal tax credits available as well. So we hear discussions all the time about doing away with the federal credits, but I'm not even ready to go there yet. Next slide, Nueces County, which is Corpus Christi, Texas, also a solar thermal system, 84 collectors and a 25-kilowatt PV system all bundled into a larger performance contract. And one of the things I think that we still need to do in the next slide is drive down the installed costs for these thermal systems. The right idea is less manual labor on the roof. Johns Controls is a mechanical contractor, one of the largest in the country, and we are a union shop. So I can't afford to have a lot of journeymen standing on the roof putting solar collectors and solar arrays together. So more packaged systems and lower cost systems elevated to the roof is really what's necessary in order to continue to reduce those installed costs. My summary slide is performance contracting is a great vehicle for financing projects when there's no capital budget available. We've got to find that low-hanging fruit like lighting and water savings in order to buy down those renewable energy systems. And the bundled approach to efficiency and renewables is really a good idea. And we heard President Clinton down in Orlando at the solar conference indicate that energy efficiency and renewable energy systems marry up quite well, and I'm finding that's true. And as we've heard from both Zach and Dale, that third-party financing, it's got to be able to cash flow a project, which is not always easy, so they're generally going to have to work in states with high incentives. But in my case, I don't always have that third-party financing approach available to me, so we've got to make it fit within a single performance contract. And with that, I am completed.
Great, thanks, Bill. This is Jill again, and I'm sorry I was dropped off for a couple minutes there. I actually was posing a really good question and realized that no one was able to hear me. So I think there's time for quite a few questions, and I encourage all of you to type in your questions, and we will deal with them as they come in. The question/comment that I had, I was originally going to address to Zach, but Bill, I think you might have some comments on it also. Earlier, I typed up a response to someone who had asked a question, and I was thinking about this solar water heating contract because of its financing mechanism as a PPA. And we often talk about it as a PPA. If it were, and that would imply electricity, there would be limitations with having multiple customers from a single system. But it occurred to me that this is not a power purchase agreement, but really an energy purchase agreement. And I think perhaps, therefore, there is a lot more flexibility in working with solar water heating relative to working with PV. So, Bill, I wonder if you could comment on that, and then, Zach, you might want to comment on that also.
Yeah, I think that's very true, you know, and we do also understand that in the cases of solar water heating systems, as a distributed energy system, it's going to be difficult to find larger projects like Dale did at the Turkey facility and at public housing. When we start having distributed systems around a campus, aggregating all of those can be somewhat tedious and also expensive because of the metering required. So the ability to aggregate through a master program is really a good way to go. It will definitely reduce those transactional costs when we look at the energy service agreement on 50, 100, 200 collector arrays. It's not always going to be that simple to do. Zach?
Very much. I mean, there's more opportunity, as you said. There are certain states that don't allow PPAs where this is not because there are electric utility requirements around the sale of electricity. We sell heat. We don't sell electricity. We don't sell gas. We haven't had those issues. And specifically to Bill's point, we've definitely it is expensive. We've done multiple campus style setups, and it. You know, unless the projects are big enough on an individual basis, it absolutely is expensive to monitor them on a per-system basis. We do that. It is expensive. It's the path we've chosen for the model that we have, and we've tried to cut down our costs by having things like wireless radios at the, let's say, 10 buildings that we did for the City of Annapolis's publicly owned city housing. Wireless radios that all backhaul to one, basically to one touch point with the internet, so to one router. So you try and cut down on those costs, but it's definitely expensive to go that model, and it's I won't call it a flaw in the path that we've chosen. It's just a part of the path we've chosen on doing those distributed campus style systems. It's a cost that we have to factor in.
Now, Zach, I don't know if there are people on the line who might be energy managers for apartment complexes, but you mentioned that you do apartment complexes or apartment buildings. Do you have individual metering for those, or is that also through a master tenant?
So we, for solar water heating, it's pretty hard, if not impossible, to deal with individual water heaters. And put a system on that serves, you know, that would pipe to each individual unit. So we do stick with people with apartments with central boilers, and therefore generally the apartment owner, or it could be the apartment manager, but generally the owner is our tenant. If they pass that through to the customers, that's at their discretion, but it is. It really, we stick to apartments that are kind of 50 units and up that are on a central boiler. And, you know, there was a period of time where building owners stopped putting water heaters, stopped building them in a central fashion. It's significantly more expensive to put an individual water heater in each unit up front and ongoing, but it solves a problem for apartment building owners of having to float any portion of the utilities for their customers. And so, obviously, we can't handle those buildings, and then we do a lot of buildings, therefore, that were kind of pre-1990, but also we've seen a little bit of a shift back the other direction because it is significantly more capital efficient to have that central boiler than to have the units in every single apartment. But that does lead us to only dealing with those master metered facilities from a water heating perspective only. They could certainly be individually metered on everything else.
Zach, there was another question. Several people were curious about the buyout terms for your agreement, if you could go into that a little more.
Absolutely. In order to be an operating lease, which these are, and an operating lease meaning it's on our balance sheet and not yours as a facility owner, there's a number of tests that you have to pass, but one is that you can't promise a buyout of a dollar at the end of 10 years, let's say. It has to be at the then-defined fair market value. Now, we think that number will probably be fairly low, certainly significantly lower than buying up front now, and is based on expected future cash flows minus the cost of removing the system. And we own this asset, and at the end of 10 years, if you told us, hey, just remove it, contractually we have to do that, you could take your savings and tell us to walk away with our equipment. So you certainly have an attempt to get that down to a very reasonable and hopefully not too onerous range. But again, in order to pass the test of being an operating lease, it does have to be at a then-defined fair market value. So there's no intent to be ambiguous. Excuse me on my part. That's the rules we have to play by, but I think it is most likely a fairly small percentage of what it was today when we installed the system.
Thank you. We also had a question up here from Mike Hogan, and I don't know exactly who this was addressed to, but anyone who works with housing, is the approved by HUD an LIHTC investors project? Investors project by project or a general compliance ruling?
I spoke to that. That's a great question. This is Zach speaking. It is project by project. There is no blanket format. We found with some potential customers, the reason that I included that, what we found with some potential customers, if you're saving a modest amount of money every year, going through the process, doing the legal review, if you didn't have some high degree of confidence that your lenders were going to approve this contract, that could certainly be a deterrent. So being able to show signed letters on past LIHTC or HUD approval has been a significant step for us in removing the barrier of somebody saying, I know I'm going to save something, but if I've got to go through 6 months of back and forth, and hope that this goes through, being able to demonstrate that the same piece of paper passed previously while we do have to go through approval again, it does grease the skids a little bit, and we're fortunate and grateful to have passed in the past, but it is certainly no guarantee, and there is no blanket approval or blanket approval process for that matter.
We had a question from Allison Carmel about RECs, and it's funny, I think of James Critchfield from EPA as possibly a good person to respond to this. The question is, could you go into a little more detail about how one would go about getting RECs for a solar thermal system? Who do you reach out to? Now, from my perspective, of course, working with utilities, if you were doing the system yourself, you could go to the utility and see if they wanted to deal with the RECs. But more likely, you would be working with your provider. So any of these people that we've had on today would have within their company people who are expert in making those kinds of REC deals if it was appropriate in the state that you're in. But, James, you might want to comment a little on the metering of these systems, because if you can't count it, you can't get RECs for it.
Yeah. Well, there's several states that actually provide RECs to solar thermal systems, North Carolina being one of them, I believe. And it's a little bit of a different ball game than, say, when you're dealing with solar PV. And it really depends on what your intention is. If you're doing this in a state where you're getting incentive value through the REC exchange with the state or utility, there's a process that'll be defined for that. If you're doing it from a sort of voluntary perspective, there are no real RECs for solar thermal, primarily because RECs in the voluntary sense are defined by typically electricity markets. And as it stands right now, a solar thermal system in most cases, particularly in a commercial application, would likely be reducing on-site fuel use, which starts to get into the offset product market, and that's a slightly different ball of wax in terms of monetizing the environmental benefits that would come off of a project like that. And the markets for those types of systems and the RECs that are offsets that would come off of them are still in their infancy in a lot of cases, and there's a lot of hoops that one would have to jump through to ensure that the reductions are real and lasting and long term. So it's an easy question on the surface, but I think it's a difficult one to answer generally.
But I do think that in the case of a solar thermal developer, that they have, if applicable, a way of dealing with that. And Zach, I know you would bundle those. I imagine Dale, you probably would also when you go to your finance banker or agency, correct?
And this is Dale. We definitely bundle the renewable energy certificates, and from all our projects, and we generally sell to a utility or to another aggregator. So we're technically an aggregator, but there are online auctions that you can subscribe to, and if you just look for under SREC trading, there's different sites that can direct you to different markets and where you might be able to sell them. The problem comes in for smaller systems and trying to sell the RECs off of, say, one single-family system or even a system that has 20 or 30 panels. You're just not generating enough renewable energy certificates to make it worthwhile. So as Zach does and we do, and I'm sure Bill does, you aggregate those RECs and then you can sell them in a larger trunk.
Thank you. I welcome others to ask your questions. I think we've got still a little bit more time to do that. And my question back to the entire group goes back to a point raised, I think, Dale, you raised it first, but it keeps coming up, and that is the competitiveness of solar water heating in an environment where natural gas costs are so low. You know, many of us believe that we're not going to bet on low natural gas costs forever, and yet if you're in the position of being an energy manager for a large facility, it's difficult to make a long-term argument to corporate headquarters. How do you deal with the questions that come up about the cost effectiveness of solar water heating versus natural gas?
And this is Dale again. That is it's a big challenge for us. And even at the low prices where natural gas is right now, with the financing model that we have, we're able to be relatively competitive, but not really competitive enough, as Bill mentioned, do these large-scale projects and repeat them. We are able to be very competitive where we are replacing electricity or propane or oil as the heating source. And I think long-term acceptability and large projects are going to require us to be able to be more competitive against natural gas. We also agree that they're not going to stay at these levels, but even if they are, we're adopting many of the techniques that you saw Bill showing in his slides, is prepackaging of systems and pre-assembly and a lot of work to reduce the site, the time, the labor time on site. And as we are able to drive the cost down, we don't have that far to go to where we can once again be very cost competitive against natural gas even at the current rates. So we may be lagging a little bit where we'd like to be able to compete directly right now, but it won't take us very long as an industry to get those costs down low enough to be able to compete at almost whatever price the natural gas is.
Good. Anyone else want to comment on that?
Jill, this is Bill Guiney. I agree with Dale a lot. I mean, you know, it's really impacting the economy with low natural gas prices. It's good for the country, but certainly not good for our technologies. But thankfully, natural gas has been one of the most volatile fuels and energies that we've seen in the U.S. And once again, we're realizing that up and down cycle. I just read an article today that they're expecting the gas-to-liquid industry to be $5.3 billion by next year. So as that natural gas is consumed by utilities that are switching from coal, as we're seeing it enter its way more into the transportation sector and the liquefaction and export of natural gas, we'll see prices escalate again. And Johns Controls does have a group that monitors natural gas wells, drills, the whole nine yards. And my indications show that we see slight upticks in natural gas prices over the next year and a half. And even at those uptick prices, it's still going to be a challenge in areas where we do not have incentives for solar water heating.
And that, Jill, this is Dale. That's a great point in that to compete against natural gas right now, we have to do it in areas where there's incentives. We cannot do it unless there is federal and some state incentives at the current prices.
Now, I mentioned this on my slide, but I don't recall that I actually verbally mentioned it. Anyone who is not familiar with the Desire website should definitely go there and check it out. It's DSIREUSA.org, and that is the website that lists state incentives for every state in the nation, a whole variety of different incentives, and incentives for not only the water heating, PV, energy efficiency, perhaps if you're putting a package together or you're looking for another department like a HUD or a military incentive. That's all listed on that website, so it's a great resource. I have another question here. It's projected to be an El Nino winter, so perhaps the Midwest and East Coasts are cold this winter, driving up demand and thus the cost of natural gas. That was more of a comment, but I hope it's an El Nino winter because I'm living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where unless that thing starts blowing this way, we're going to have a real dry winter. So the weather, of course, is as unpredictable as any energy price. Any other questions from the group?
Gil, I do have a comment about renewable energy certificates and RECs as far as Johns Controls and our performance contracting goes. I've never been able to monetize RECs because 99% of our customers want to keep their environmental attributes in order to reduce their own carbon footprint and to meet their sustainability goals. So while it can certainly be a very good market for the commercial sector, as Dale indicated, they need those incentives and they need those RECs to work. We're hoping that as our discussions start to revolve in Washington around an energy policy and the potential for a national portfolio standard, renewable portfolio standard, that solar water heating and solar thermal technologies are included in each of those states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it is a negotiable part of the contract agreement. As I mentioned, most solar developers want to include it because that's what their financing is involved with, but there are also a number of for example, local government or a military that would need to keep those RECs. And that was why we were talking with James Critchfield about this, too. There is a great advance in solar thermal metering where you can be tracking the energy value of a solar water heating system. And, in fact, that leads me to a thought about a last question for this group. I had the opportunity when I was doing best practices research in commercial solar water heating to talk to each of you or your colleagues about the details about how you monitor and meter these systems and how sophisticated that has become, so that in many cases, you know, from a remote site, you know before the customer does whether there's an operational problem. So while it's not strictly on the financing question, I think it is on everyone's minds. How do each of you address the ongoing operations, maintenance, and quality assurance for these systems? And maybe we'll just start with Dale and kind of go down the group.
Sure. That's a great question, because that comes up all the time for us. And we do monitor every system, just like Zach does, and I'm sure Bill does. And we get daily feeds so that if there is an issue where the system needs maintenance or needs somebody to go look at it, we have staff here in-house that we send out. We also do routine maintenance checks on these systems. And then we have in many of the states that we're in, we have subcontractors or plumbing and heating contractors or mechanical contractors that we can call upon that we've already trained how to work on these systems. So a lot of times it's we have a 24-hour response time for a kind of a routine issue where maybe the system is just not producing or a pump is out, and we have a matter of hour response time if there is a significant problem where there may be some fluid or something that's coming out. So we do it many different ways. We have in-house people that are trained, and we have subcontractors that we rely upon to do that.
Zach, a few comments on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think as I spoke to you before, I mean, all three of us, if the systems don't perform, we don't get paid. We all have different funding mechanisms, but that part is the case for all of us. And for Dale and I, we actually don't get paid the revenue. And for Bill, you know, if the system's underperformed, then performance contract kicks in and he's got his guarantee. So we're all on the hook. We are at Skyline, and we started as a bunch of data geeks, a bunch of energy monitoring software guys. And, you know, I think one of the things that we focus very hard on is trying to not just cut down the number of issues, but also know ahead of time. And this is why we probably, by some stretches, we over-measure a little bit, but by measuring so many data points on the system, we don't just know that something's wrong. We generally know where it's wrong, and that cuts down a little bit of time on site and someone showing up. It's not just that the meter stops spinning. It's that we might know that the generation loop has an issue in a certain place, because we can see from all those different data points, we're not just measuring energy delivered, but temperatures and flows all over the place. I mean, measuring temperatures and flows is not a new thing, and so the ability to determine how much energy is delivered is not new. The ability to pair that up with easy internet backhaul and have that in a presentable form that somebody can make, as Dale's mentioned, same-day decisions, that is the real, I think, advance here for all of us. So we're on the same page there that, you know, we're trying to find things before the customer knows. And one anecdote on that is that we've had a handful of times where the customer's water heater itself, which has nothing to do with us, you know, we're delivering heat into it, but the water heater will go down and the customer will call us because they know that we're measuring a bunch of different points to find out what's going wrong. And we don't get paid for that, but we certainly hope somebody signs up another building because we've helped them in a way that by doing those measurements. So there's some peripheral value, I think, to all of us in doing that.
Great. And Bill, we're kind of out of time, but I know that you also do that kind of monitoring.
I do, and also we provide the O&M on these projects for the term of the contract, and then potentially we will turn it over to our service business for a continuing maintenance agreement on the facility. But during the term of the contract, it's critical for me to make sure that it's been installed right, we have high-quality components on it, and the reliability is built into the design. It's very important to me. I can't afford repairs and maintenance costs down the road.
Great. Well, I want to thank each of you. We're about out of time here, and many of you are already on the mailing list for these webinars. I'm sure that you'll be looking forward to the next one, and James will be sending you information. I think as a bottom line consideration, with the solar water heating, it is a decision that is sometimes part of an energy efficiency overhaul. It is sometimes something perhaps that you just want to do to green your company, to create more excitement about your facility. There are many reasons to do it, and I think hopefully today you've learned that there are many ways to achieve that end. So thank you very much to each of our speakers, and thanks to each of our guests today.
Thank you, Jill. This is James Critchard with EPA. I'd again like to echo that. Thank you to each of our speakers. We really appreciate your time today. In terms of our attendees, a copy of today's presentation will be made available, as well as an audio encore presentation that you'll be receiving information on within the next day or so on how to access both of those pieces, both the presentation and the audio. If you have any further questions, please feel free to contact me. My contact information is on the website. And, of course, I'm sure if you follow up with each of our speakers individually, they'll be able to help you or one of the people on their team. And, again, thank you for everyone, and we will see you next time.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's call. We thank you again for your participation, and we do ask that you disconnect your lines at this time.